From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, September 7th, 2016. And on this day, is it hate speech or free expression? A public mural in Portland that first depicted Governor Paul LePage as a KKK Grand Wizard and later with Mickey Mouse ears stirs debate. The limp lettuce and soggy squash you throw into the garbage could be on its way to a new life as compost or energy. And the former host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen, Chris Kimball, launches a new venture showcasing what he calls new home cooking. Those stories and more coming up. This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and Kennebec Valley Community College, offering a late start semester beginning September 26th. kvcc.me.edu. I'm Barbara Caridi. A public mural in Portland that first depicted Governor Paul LePage as a KKK Grand Wizard and later with Mickey Mouse ears is at the center of some debate. Some city officials want the mural, which is on a public building, to be painted over. But as Fred Bever reports, others point to the history of the space as a canvas for free expression.
The mural first came to light Tuesday on a 100-foot-long wall by a walking path that snakes between the city's water treatment plant and Casco Bay. "Dump LePage," it said in 10-foot-high letters, accompanied by a portrait of the governor clad in Klansman's garb and describing him as a racist and homophobe. Mayor Ethan Strimling, who's been trying to repair the city's frayed relations with LePage, said the mural should come down, as did many locals, even those who, like Strimling, are condemning LePage for his comments on race and his curse-laden voicemail that he recently left for a lawmaker. But overnight, television station WCSH documented a kind of competition between people trying to whitewash the mural and those trying to keep it intact. By Wednesday, LePage's Klan ropes were gone, replaced by a pair of Mickey Mouse ears.
Yeah, I'm okay with where it's at now.
That's Mayor Strimling.
Political speech is very important. Political art is very important in our community. And the expression of that, when you trivialize the KKK, the way that was originally depicting Grand Wizard, that to me was the issue that went too far.
The mural has now become a bit of a local attraction. Mark Rodrigue of Poland and a friend made their way down to Portland's East End to check it out.
The statement is, I think it's an expression of how a lot of people feel right now, and you know, as indelicate as it is, I think it expresses that.
Well, we are concerned about the negativity surrounding our property.
Michelle Clements is a spokesperson for the Portland Water District, which owns the wall. She says terms such as racist and homophobe are derogatory.
And our general manager feels the current use of the graffiti wall inappropriate. And we are consulting with the city to see what steps can be taken and exploring, you know, options.
It's unclear just what those might be. Although the Water District owns the wall, it's been in use as a public canvas for 15 years. Ever since then, Police Chief Michael Chitwood made a verbal agreement with the district to allow graffiti and other artists free rein there. Zachary Hayden, legal director for the ACLU of Maine, says when governments establish public forums, the courts frown on attempts to limit their use, regardless of the content.
You're not allowed to make a threat against somebody in a way that causes them to fear imminent bodily harm. But in terms of being offensive and saying things that are offensive, that's generally permitted under our First Amendment. The courts and our Constitution say that in such a situation, the proper remedy is disagreement, more speech, rather than enforced silence.
A spokesperson for the city says there are no plans to paint the mural over. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
In Bangor, a former banker there says he'll launch a write-in campaign as an independent candidate for Maine's 2nd Congressional District in an effort to defeat Republican incumbent Bruce Poliquin. 61-year-old Jay Dresser says that as a former member of both the Republican and Democratic parties, he's convinced that neither party offers candidates who can effectively represent the district's voters.
I feel like the both parties represent more large institutions than they do the everyday citizen. And I will advocate for both institutions, the elite and the common citizen, and I will be accessible.
Dresser is making his first run at elected office. He says he wants to redirect large portions of the U.S. military budget for diplomatic purposes and end the country's production of weaponry, including warships, jet fighters, and tanks. Meanwhile, the largest and most expensive destroyer ever built for the U.S. Navy left Bath Iron Works today. Hundreds of spectators gathered to watch the stealthy Zumwalt destroyer depart from the Bath shipyard en route to its commissioning in Baltimore. From there, the 610-foot ship heads to its home port in San Diego. The futuristic-looking warship features an angular shape to minimize its radar signature, along with an unconventional hull, a powerful new gun system, and a composite deckhouse that hides the radar and sensors. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve's latest so-called beige book, an assessment of economic conditions, is out. And in New England, it finds some growth in economic activity, but also scattered signs that the rate of growth is slowing. Erwin Gratz has more.
The Federal Reserve says the sales of retailers ranged from down slightly to up 2-4% over a year ago. Clothing and footwear are selling well. Furniture and other household goods, not so much. The Fed contacted 7 manufacturing firms, 6 of which said their business is improving. Commercial real estate results vary, slower in Hartford and Providence, better from Boston northward. Looking at residential real estate, the Fed Beige Book reports pending condo sales were softer except here in Maine and in Massachusetts. Erwin Gratz, Maine Public Radio News.
Coming up, turning food waste into energy, and a talk with former America's Test Kitchen host Chris Kimball about his new venture. Down in Washington, Maine Senator Susan Collins is calling for federal action to address the growing gap between retirement savings and retirement needs. Collins chairs the Senate Committee on Aging, which held a hearing today on the issue. Mal Leary reports.
Senator Collins says the gap between retirement savings and retirement needs is estimated at over $7 trillion. She says Congress needs to do more to encourage savings, pointing to another study that indicates most Americans do not have the cash to meet a $400 unplanned need. Collins says part of the solution is her legislation to encourage small businesses to offer retirement plans. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
And now to food. Open up a refrigerator and the chances of finding limp lettuce or soggy squash are pretty high. And here in the U.S., it's likely that this food will find its way into the garbage. According to the USDA, at least 30% of the nation's food supply is wasted. A new program launched today by Portland-based EcoMaine aims to get that food out of the trash and give it a second life as compost or energy. Patty White reports.
When confronted with produce past its prime, says EcoMaine CEO Kevin Roach, there's really one major roadblock that steers people towards dropping it in the trash versus a compost bucket.
The ick factor is what I call it.
Rotten food is messy. It smells. It attracts fruit flies. But Roach says EcoMaine now has a unique way to manage the ick factor by sealing that food waste in a clear plastic bag.
You go to the grocery store, and when you buy your oranges or your head of broccoli, the first thing you usually do is put it in a clear bag. And we feel that that could be an avenue for us to contain the ick factor and get a second use out of that bag.
Starting Wednesday, EcoMaine accepts food waste knotted up in plastic bags. EcoMaine doesn't collect it itself. It consolidates waste picked up by commercial services, such as Garbage to Garden or We Compost It, at a cost of about $55 a ton. On Wednesday morning, a collection truck from AgriCycle Energy unloads a giant salad of rotten corn, peppers, tomatoes, and other produce at EcoMaine's facility in Portland.
We're collecting from restaurants, colleges, hospitals, and a variety of other generators of food waste.
Dan Bell is the manager at AgriCycle Energy in Exeter. That's actually where all of this produce consolidated at EcoMaine will eventually go. A special machine at AgriCycle Energy removes the plastic bags, which are returned to EcoMaine to be burned for electricity. The food waste, meanwhile, is blended with an equal amount of cow manure from a nearby dairy farm, then heated and churned for about 30 days using a process called anaerobic digestion.
We have two large domes. It's essentially enclosed. So we're capturing all of the gases in the process of breaking down food waste.
The biogas is used to produce heat and electricity, and the food waste, says Bell, turns into fertilizer and animal bedding.
This is material that's been in the waste stream forever, and it always will be, and it'll always be something we have to be handled. But by pulling that out and removing it and source separating it allows companies like ours and other digesters across the country to put that material to work for us versus just sitting in a landfill.
Because food generally doesn't break down in landfills. Kevin Roach of EcoMaine says a couple years ago, the company dug down into one of its own landfills.
We found chicken breasts that were 25 years old, tomatoes, Ruffles potato chips that were 25 years old.
Roach says businesses and consumers can prevent food waste through correct planning. But when lost or forgotten food is discovered in the dark recesses of a fridge, that's where EcoMaine's food waste recovery program comes in. Initially, he says, it won't account for a huge chunk of what EcoMaine processes, which amounts to 170,000 tons of trash and 45,000 tons of recycling per year. But
even if we can get upwards, you know, toward 5,000 tons a year, you know, we feel that that would be a good start to our program.
It's an important step, says Roach, toward reaching Maine's statewide recycling goal of 50% by 2021. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
And continuing with the food theme, if you're a public television fan, you're probably familiar with Chris Kimball, the spectacled bow-tied founder and former host of the popular PBS program America's Test Kitchen. Kimball has moved on to start a new multimedia project called Milk Street Kitchen, and tomorrow he kicks off a national tour in Portland to promote the effort. Today, Kimball was in our Portland studios and spoke with Maine Public Radio's Jennifer Rooks about his new focus, bringing bolder flavors from around the world to what he calls new home cooking.
The way I've cooked all my life is very Northern European. A lot of fuel, a lot of meat, a lot of dairy, a lot of bread, a lot of root vegetables. But not a lot of herbs, not a lot of spices, not a lot of chilies, not a lot of fermented sauces. Very different way of thinking about cooking. Less dependent on heat for developing flavor, less dependent on technique. So the new home cooking is looking around and going, yeah, well, that's easier, or why don't we just do it this way, or why don't we use grains or herbs? You know, herbs, for example, lots of cultures, they throw handfuls of herbs in. If you make a stew in the Ukraine, you get some water, you get some meat, you throw it in, maybe some beans, cook it for 3 hours, and then throw two or three handfuls of herbs in at the end, you're done. Well, that's a very different use of herbs than the sprig of thyme, which drives me insane. In French, what is a sprig of thyme going to do? Nothing. And so it's a totally different way of thinking about food. I give Otto Lenghi, Yotam Otto Lenghi, who wrote Plenty in Jerusalem, a lot of credit because he was one of the first people to really internationalize this way of thinking about food, which is quite different.
Have you gone through a change yourself in how you think about food in the 30 years that you've been doing this?
Yeah, about 5 years ago, I started cooking out of a lot of different books. I traveled. I was in Morocco and cooked a tagine with someone. And he didn't brown the chicken. He didn't brown the onions. He just threw it all together, heated up the onions for a couple minutes in the oil, put the chicken in, olives, preserved lemon, cumin, ginger, saffron. And a couple hours later, each individual note, you know, was distinctly there, but it wasn't melded together. So my feeling is a lot of the cooking I have been doing, much of which I love. I mean, I'm sorry, the Europeans don't get fruit pies like we do. They're much better. But it's melding. It's a real melting pot approach. The rest of the world doesn't do that. There's more individual flavor sometimes that stay around. And that's, I think, much more in keeping with what people want now. They want bigger flavors. They want brighter flavors. They want more distinctive flavors in their food. So the new home cooking is really trying to figure out how to do that.
It's interesting to me because so much of what America's Test Kitchen has done is found the best way to do something, even if it's something simple. And it seems like maybe now we're turning this a little bit on our head, that there can be a more than one best way to do something.
It's more stepping way back and going, what is cooking? it's really questioning the fundamental precepts of the cuisine. So if you step way out of Northern European cooking and look around the world, the answers are very different. So if you want to get to a poached chicken, for example, sure, once you settle on a technique, you can test the best way to do that. But it's the original idea I'm interested in. For example, about a year ago, I was scrambling eggs. I just grabbed some olive oil, threw in the skillet. It turned out that the eggs just puffed right up. They were totally different. And then if you look at every other culture except France, really, they cook eggs in oil, you know. And so we figured out, okay, there's a lot of science behind it, but it makes better scrambled eggs. About a month later, I was looking through a Basque cookbook, and there was a recipe, 2 eggs, 1 tablespoon olive oil. You know, so as a friend of mine said, there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, everything's been done. It's just a question of reaching out and trying to figure out what has been done.
Chris Kimball, I'm really interested in how you got started on this journey, because you didn't start off by going to cooking school. You didn't work for a magazine first and learn how to run a magazine.
Ignorance is bliss. I mean, Julia Child always used to reprimand me. You should go, you know, you should go to Cordon Bleu. You should go cook in France and this and the other thing. Maybe, but my retort always is I didn't know anything, and therefore I was the perfect customer for what I was doing, because I could ask all the dumb questions. And once in a while, you know, we just came up with a pie pastry recipe, for example, that after 35 years in this business finally works and is foolproof and ends up not shrinking when you pre-bake it.
So where are we going to find this pie pastry
in
recipe?
In the charter issue. That was an unfortunate commercial message in the charter issue of Milk Street. But it's a technique from Japan, actually, that we adapted. And it's terrific. So yeah, I've been trying to get this recipe done for 20 years, and we finally got it.
And that was former America's Test Kitchen host Chris Kimball talking with Jennifer Rooks about his new venture called Milk Street Kitchen. Kimball appeared on today's Main Calling program. If you missed it, you can hear the entire show on our website, mpbn.net. And for urban dwellers who want to raise their own food, the city of Lewiston is making it a little easier. The city council voted last night to allow some people to raise egg-laying hens in their backyards. Up to 6 hens, not roosters, are allowed on properties of 30,000 square feet or more, with no more than a single-family dwelling. City Councilor Michael Achance voted for the new ordinance. He says it opens up a lot of opportunities, but it doesn't include everyone.
Yeah, smaller lots, multifamily, 2-3 units, stuff like that. Those types of properties are excluded regardless of the zone.
People who live in the city's downtown and some industrial zones still won't be allowed to keep hens. Neighboring Auburn also allows hens with some restrictions, as do most of Maine's bigger urban areas. Bangor prohibits chickens except in the city's rural residence and agricultural zones. Proponents of the new rule had hoped it would apply to smaller properties, about 0.5 acre. LaChance says the 30,000-square-foot rule is better than nothing. And finally, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
The coastal plain will remain in the soup tonight. Dense fog reforming. This saturated air will press inland to the foothills, Arno and Topsfield late. Thickening clouds farther north. Very muggy and mild, 61 to 66. Tomorrow will be the most humid day of the week. Abundant cloud cover will reside over northern, western, and down east Maine, but once the fog lifts throughout the remainder of the state, intervals of sunshine. Still a few isolated sprinkles, especially in the St. John Valley and the down east coast. Low to mid-70s coast to far north, 80 throughout the bulk of the interior. Friday will most definitely be the hottest day of the week for all but the far north, where a few clouds linger, along with a stiff northwest breeze. Mostly sunny for a majority, a tad drier. A wide range in temperatures, 72 to 90 north to south. Saturday, pleasant and more comfortable. Bright morning sun fading during the afternoon. 70s north and coast, low 80s for the rest of the state. A cool front will bulldoze showers and isolated thunderstorms through Maine Sunday morning. Breezy and warm with partial clearing during the afternoon. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public Broadcasting.
That's the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, September 7th, 2016. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Fred Bever, A.J. Higgins, Mal Leary, Patty White, Erwin Gratz, Ed Morin, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public Broadcasting, thanks for listening.